Welcome to the Hypnosis NGH podcast. This podcast series offers a fun and serious look at hypnosis and offers various ideas, discuss case studies, along with NGH educational opportunities. Welcome to the Hypnosis NGH podcast. Hello, everyone. I'm Eric Damon with the National Guild of Hypnotists. We appreciate that you're joining us for our podcast today. We do have a special guest that we're excited about. He's an experienced clinical hypnotist and hypnotherapy trainer, has extensive knowledge with hypnosis, blends hypnotherapy teaching and training design, very busy London-based hypnotherapy practice, does hypnotherapy research, international speaker and presenter, and clinical hypnosis work with London Teaching Hospital. Board certified, please welcome Dr. Kate Bevan-Marks.
How long have you been doing hypnosis?
Pretty long while. I've been teaching it about 25 years, I think. Yeah, I've always been really interested in the psychology of communication and how we communicate with each other, both verbally and non-verbally. Although the majority of my learning has been in the verbal side, I tend to hit up friends that are body language experts and go, I think they're doing that. Can you confirm or deny? And I'm getting there, but it's the words that get me. Many years ago, I worked in risk management and occupational health in high-risk industries. And it's the sort of place where if you fell into a machine, you wouldn't be noticed in the metal stream that came out the other end. So it's pretty high risk. And it was very much a don't do this environment. There were warnings everywhere. And as you know, and as listeners will know, if you tell somebody not to do something like don't walk on the grass, the very first thing that you think of doing is walking on the grass.
That's very true.
Yeah, is the grass springy? Is it soft? Is it nice? But as adults, we rebel against being told what not to do. And you're introducing something that people wouldn't even have thought of often. So my move there was to transform the language into do this. And if you have four do thises, the one don't that is essential, critical, people will pay attention to. Otherwise, if you have don'ts everywhere, they become blind to it. It's a bit like with smokers. In the UK, cigarette packets have got foul, disgusting images on now. Decayed lungs and things like that. But there's a blindness to it. People don't notice it anymore because the message is always there. So with language, if you tell somebody all the time what not to do, they just start to ignore the message. It loses impact. So that whole psychology of communication was always interesting to me. So I started looking into different forms of hypnosis. The difference between Ericksonian language and maybe going something indirect, what that gives you compared to what a metaphor would give you or what something more direct would give you. And certainly I found that from a locus of control perspective, people who are quite external and want to be told what to do, my metaphor is more challenging than people who are more internal and collaborative.
Interesting.
So I sort of personality typing, individual differences, all of that comes into how I like to use language. But it's an enormous field to explore.
That's not a simple task.
No.
At all.
But it's so interesting. It's really good to work out what makes people tick.
Yes. No, I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah. If you know, you can help them.
So from the private sector, working, you know, in a high-risk occupation, you got pulled into hypnosis by by reading people that in that sense, that's what pulled you in? In a personal sense of using hypnosis wanting to help?
I got into it initially from the language side of things.
Yeah.
So from the work side of things and how we can influence people. And that included from an occupational health side of things, how you can help people make changes that they own. And that, I think, is really, really important in the workplace where care is provided for you. Say somebody might send you to a counsellor for 6 sessions,
right,
and there's no cost. There isn't as much ownership,
right,
because you're not having to pay for it. You often go in work time, which means if you're stressed from work, you're being rewarded by going to a counsellor in work time. There's no cost to you, but then there's not as much ownership.
Right.
So how can you get that person more engaged in owning their change process? And I think then you get a more genuine change,
right,
because they'll accept that they have a part to play in why they're stressed.
Absolutely.
It's not just the evil employer making them stressed. And I use, in my corporate work, I use a phrase that comes from rational emotive behavior therapy. And it's the difference between she made me cry and I responded to what she said by being upset. She made me cry is disempowering. It says that that person has the power to make you cry. But unless they stick their fingers in your eyes, they're not really going to be able to do that. But it's how you respond to what they say. And that comes down to, I think, Epictetus, if we want to go to early philosophy. And events don't make us feel anything. It's how we feel about those events that leads to what we feel.
Absolutely.
So by using my hypnotic language and all that I learned from communication from that world, I was able to help people start to realize that they can take emotional responsibility for their change.
And that's where your focus has been. Now, did you...
It
was then. as you progress into hypnosis, do you still... you say you present a lot of presentations. Do you have clients that you see?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The majority of my time, I mean, that was the very earliest start of my career. I then started training and working as a hypnotherapist. And then I quite quickly got into teaching because people would say, well, how did you do that? So I'm like, oh, let me show you. And my doctorate is a proper, an official university-based doctorate of education.
Oh, great.
Where I explored how people learn hypnotherapy and hypnosis and how it's taught from a professionalism perspective. And that was fascinating. And that gave me so much that I could then put into my teaching and just cherry pick out all the good bits that I thought were really relevant. For me, and it's only my personal view, I think to be a trainer or a teacher, you have to still see clients. You have to be connected to how what you're teaching actually works. You have to know that this technique, this control room of the mind technique that I'm teaching for help with tinnitus actually works with tinnitus. And I want to be able to say, let's call this guy Charlie, and he came in and this was his problem. The London Underground trains are rather noisy. He's been on them for years. He's got some tinnitus as a result, according to his audiologist. And this is how you can use control room to help with that. I think you need those teaching. Erickson was amazing at tales.
Yeah.
And I think teaching tales brings to life the material that you teach. And I think students will remember the teaching tales sometimes more than they'll remember the hard facts.
Structure.
Yeah.
No, I agree with that. That's funny because I interviewed a hypnotist earlier, and she was basically singing a rhyme type poem to me, and I just looked at her. This was before we started recording. And I looked at her and said, "What's that?" She said, "When she was a child in grade school, that's how she learned for certain things, was to associate it with a poem or a rhyme." And so that makes a lot of sense. I mean, that people, they learn better that way and remember things.
You know, I think so.
Instead of taking that book and underlining everything or whatever.
You just learn how to underline and which colors you prefer as highlighter.
Now, you strike me as a person that just loves to soak in as much information and education that you can and use it to the best of your ability for what you do. Is that?
Yeah, I love every time I go to a conference, I will come back and review our syllabus and I will review our training. And there'll be little tweaks. It's because I think if I was to have a superpower, it's that I can synergize information. So I can take something from here, something from there, and bring it together. And I like to do that with what I pick up from each conference or each training that I attend.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you get bits of information, even if it's not the whole thing. If you can take a little bit out of each one.
Yeah,
for your own, to help your own clients and yourself. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think a lot of people, if they're not doing it, they should be, because they can grow.
Oh, totally. And talking of clients, I still learn from every client that I work with.
That's good.
After every session, I will sit and I will reflect, even if it's only for a couple of minutes. You know, what did I get from that session? What new learning have I got? And there will always be something that you can think, oh, actually, that was interesting. I noticed that they responded more to that side of things than that side. I'll give you an example. I've got one lady who, she comes into my therapy room and it's a two-seater sofa that they can choose to sit on or a harder chair. They've got the choice. And she always sat on one side of the sofa. And she was quite a resistant lady. She sort of wanted change, but didn't want change. And I think she was sort of on the fence. And one day, I asked her if she would like to sit on the other side of the sofa. And it was just because the light was coming in and I could see her. I didn't want to close the blinds because it's nice to have natural light in a therapy room. And she was sitting there, she was squinting against the light. So, would you like to just move over and you'll be out of the sun? And she did. The difference in her attitude in that session, shocking.
Really?
And I was thinking, when did she just change her attitude? Did she come in with a more positive attitude? And I don't know whether it was she'd initially anchored her resistance to change to that side of the sofa when she first came for her first session. Yeah. But just by moving to a different seat, a different view of the room, maybe that was enough to shift her into a new way of thinking.
Did it upset her or did it go positive?
She was fine. She was fine, happy to move. I don't know whether she noticed the shift even. I was like, wow. So it's these little things that you get. And the message I think then for my students is, if you've got a client who's stuck, change things up. Get them to sit in your chair and you sit in their chair and just see if that interaction changes.
That's smart. Yeah, that's a good way to think about it.
Yeah. So, yeah, I do see clients. I would hate to not be able to see clients. I think I need it so that I can improve and always develop my teaching.
Now,
and my client work.
And it helps you with every client that you
see. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. I mean, you learn that. Yeah, it's like going to a conference and getting little bits and pieces, even from your clients. You're going to get bits and pieces to help them even more, and or somebody else that you see down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's so cool.
What is your, if you don't mind me asking, what is your mix of the type of clients that you see?
I don't have many client hours available in my schedule because I've got other commitments in the hypno world as well as teaching. So I tend to get the really awkward ones. So if one of my graduates has a client and they go, I can't, I'm not getting anywhere, they're, oh, go and see Kate. So I get really tricky people. I quite like that.
You have a little niche there, don't you?
Yeah. I quite like that. There was some, it was interesting. There was a guy here on Friday. We did a practical and he sort of said, oh, you know, I'm very hard to hypnotize. I'm thinking, well, you're no different to most of my clients.
Challenge accepted, right?
I have to say it was. And he did go very deeply into hypnosis.
That's great.
Because there aren't people hard to hypnotize. You just need a different approach.
Right, exactly. If somebody says that, I'm very difficult to hypnotize. You're right. There's got to be another way to do it.
Yeah.
And by, again, I keep coming back to, by you getting little bits and pieces of learning, you probably have those somewhere in your mind or repertoire that you can use them.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I think there's, in a way, I wouldn't say there are no bad clients, because some people just don't want to change and they come in to prove to others that they can't change. Right. But I think there are, if a client lacks flexibility, as a therapist, you need to be more flexible. So rather than pushing up against their rigidity, it's okay, well, if that isn't working, let's swap seats.
Yeah.
Let's go for a walk around the park and have a chat about this and just change things up a bit.
That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. So obviously you're spending a lot of time on teaching and hypnosis in England. I have to know, our podcast listeners want to know, what do you do for fun?
I don't believe that whole thing that if you enjoy what you do, it isn't work. I actually don't believe that, because I put my professionalism into what I do. But I actually enjoy what I do. I love, and I'm so grateful for the mix of what I do.
I'm sure that keeps it fresh for you.
And I think, yeah, I think one day I'm on the board with a voluntary regulator in the UK. So one day I might be giving an expert opinion on something. Another day I'm chair of the British Society of Clinical Hypnosis. So I might be doing something related to that. Another day I might be having the luxury of a whole day being able to write some work for my book. I mean, I'm one of those people, I hate having half an hour here and there. If I'm writing a book, I want to spend the whole day with it and sit there and have access to coffee and biscuits and no interruptions. And that's an absolute luxury. And then I might be teaching or marking homework. So much homework. And then I might nip up and see a client and then come back. And it's just a variety. Yeah, absolutely. I think somebody said once that I have a portfolio career. And I just think I just do a lot of stuff.
Well, that's great. I mean, you definitely have to love what you do, as you said. Especially if you're working all the time. Now, in England, what's the difference when it comes to hypnosis versus clinics, in the sense of, you talk about different counsel that you're on?
Okay, so in the UK, unlike, I don't know who it was, somebody said earlier this morning that they're not allowed, I think in one of the states, I won't say which in case I get it wrong, they're not allowed to do hypnosis because you've got to be a psychologist. We don't have that in the UK. Sadly, your neighbor could think, oh, I'll be a hypnotherapist without even reading a book.
So it's just a treat.
Yeah. So there are absolutely no licensing requirements at all, except for comedy hypnosis.
Really?
Stage Hypnosis, Hypnotism Act. It's been around a very long while.
Yes.
I think since the 1950s, off the top of my head. It was revised in the 90s. And for that, you have to have a license from a local authority. You have to have insurance, depending on which county.
What?
So for listeners in the US, which state?
State.
Yeah, yeah. Some don't know about the licensing requirements, so they'll throw the book at you. You'll have to complete lengthy risk assessments. One of my graduates who I mentor, he even had to have a meeting with a local fire brigade. I don't know what they thought was involved in hypnosis. Maybe imagining you're breathing fire, who knows? The dragon induction, that would be cool. But comedy hypnosis is licensed. Except if you're doing it for educational purposes or it's a closed event, there are exceptions.
Wow.
I know. For the hypnosis and the hypnotherapy world, we tend to use the word hypnotherapy here. It tends to be more the use of the word hypnosis,
yes,
from what I gathered. And there's different elements within that. There are hobbyists who will read a book, watch YouTube, go and play and do stuff, maybe do a couple of weekend courses here and there. Almost a bit like, and it's a phrase that's emerging, guru shopping.
Yeah.
They'll go from one model to another, but without the underpinning training and the non-sexy stuff like ethics and professional practice. So they'll have an idea, but they'll tend to deliver models. It's done on the side.
Almost like an underground type of thing.
Yeah, it's sort of like somebody might be an engineer or a baker or a car mechanic, and they might hypnotize one or two people a week on the side as a bit of side income, maybe. Then you get the people that do an entry-level practitioner training, either online or in person. And that tends to be shorter, maybe intensive, a week or two. So they get the basics. They might learn behavioral hypnotherapy, maybe even behavioral or cognitive.
Yeah.
And they tend to do the general stuff, the weight management, the stress, the anxiety. They learn that. Commonly, it's very script-based.
Okay.
So they'll learn to deliver a script. I have different views on that, but I think they're great learning tools, but they won't help.
I think a lot of people, everything. I see that have definitely been in the profession for a while, they start with scripts. And they evolve into not needing a script, but they pretty much have one in their head.
Exactly, yes.
Whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. It's sort of like you learn the bullet points, you learn the structure,
right,
and move on. But some people rely more on scripts because of their training.
Yes.
And then you get people that are higher practitioner level trained, and their training meets or exceeds the UK core curriculum. Now, you might have remembered me saying that there's no legal, yes, requirements. Back in the early 2000s, the government created national occupational standards for a whole host of different jobs: bus drivers, cleaners, nurses, doctors, dentists, you know, all sorts of different jobs. There was a standard set out. They approached stakeholders and drew up these standards, and it laid out the required practical skills and knowledge and understanding that you needed as a minimum to do that job. And there are national occupational standards for hypnotherapy. And to meet those standards, there's something called the UK Core Curriculum for Hypnotherapy.
Yes.
I know them intimately well because, being on the board with a voluntary regulator, I've led the team twice now that have reviewed them. So I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but
it has to happen, right?
And these standards lay out things like, for example, you need to have at least 120 hours face-to-face, not on Zoom, face-to-face, actual face-to-face. You need to have a mix of theory and practice. You need to have assigned homework, independent study, total learning hours of 450. You have to do case studies and have summative and formative exams. So as you go through and end exams. So there's some requirements. Not all training in the UK meets those requirements. Some does,
nor do they
some exceed it. Nor do they have to. So they don't have to. But if you want to register with a voluntary regulator, then your training has to meet those standards. And for the voluntary regulator, it's relevant if you want to work in maybe in a healthcare setting or something like that, because the Department of Health promote that doctors, dentists, healthcare practitioners only refer to people that are on that register.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Wow, that's a lot of work. That's a lot of work that you have to do in order to get, obviously you're trying to bring the profession in the UK to the standard up. If there's
any. Yeah.
You know, improve the standards so that there's a, maybe it's the minimum that people should be at, either it be regulated in some fashion or not. That's a different story, I guess.
It's my passion of all the things to have a passion about, and it's emerged, but something I feel so strongly about is standards.
Yes.
And it was something came out in my doctoral research, one of the recommendations, and it will never happen. But I have the luxury of being able to say in my doctorate, because it was my doctorate, that I recommended that everybody using hypnosis, everybody, whether you're a researcher, a hobbyist, whether you're using it with your Auntie Mabel once a week, whether you're using it for, in theatre,
yeah,
you know, for surgery, however you use it, everybody should have a certain minimum training. Even if it's only a 2-day covering safety and ethics, history, theory, structure, so that everybody has the basic capability of being professional, yes, in how they use hypnosis.
That's absolutely true. I mean, you don't want people looking, the days of the way people used to think of hypnosis should be gone
now. Yeah.
You know, and the only way to do that is exactly what you're talking about. You look at the NGA, we have ethics, standards, and, you know, practice, all of that.
Words to use.
As being part of the National Guild of Hypnotists. And those are important parts of our organization. And even to the point where people who are taking the board certification, 80% of learning is all about ethics. Because you're trying to keep our profession at a certain level and let it continue to rise from there, only to A, benefit the clients, and you as a practitioner of hypnosis, consulting hypnosis, hypnotherapy, whatever the title is, we want people to see that as a level that they can trust.
Absolutely. It is, and it's something that is important, more so now than ever before. And when I first started, I would never have a client who would Google what to expect from your hypnotherapist. These days, whether it's a teenager or my oldest client so far is 93, she Googled me. She sat there on her iPad and Googled. She Googled me. She checked out my qualifications. She asked some really interesting questions before we even had our first session. People are better informed than ever. Yes.
Yeah.
So the
information is there.
Yeah. So they need to know, where did you train? What organization you were part from? And then to look at that organization, what do they stand for? So it is important, very. Yeah,
obviously, you know, in any profession, you want to go to the one who is certified or board certified or, you know, licensed or whatever the words are that you can trust as a potential client, that these folks have the training and can try to help.
And sometimes it's a bit like one of my friends compared it to a jigsaw puzzle. Sometimes the client and the hypnotherapist fit. Other times they don't. One of my friends, she works, I'll put the polite words in. She worked her socks off to save up for a brand new car. She worked really hard for years. She didn't have holidays. She didn't have anything else. And she went out and bought a very nice brand new car. At the end of the first week, she absolutely detested and hated the car. She hated the view of the road. She hated the seat. Everything about it, even though she'd saved up for it, she didn't like. And we had a cup of coffee and we chatted about it. And she was like, I'm going to have to get used to it. I'm like, why? If it's not working for you, change. And she went out and bought a cheaper secondhand car. Because she's like, well, the novelty's worn off. And she absolutely raves over it. She's like, I want to buy one, an extra one, and put it in my garage just in case this wears out. And it's the same with hypnotherapists. You might meet somebody, on paper they look amazing, but if you don't click, for whatever reason, find another one.
I was going to say, that's okay if you don't click, because there are others that it goes with anything. I mean, one, people have gone to a dentist and they just didn't really like the dentist. He or she did fine for them on their teeth, but it's still personality, whatever.
That's it.
So change, find something.
Totally. I think it's the same with clients as well. If you're working with a client and that rapport isn't there, that you don't resonate, then maybe think about, is it worth referring them to somebody else in your office, changing things up in some way? Right. Because why push on if it isn't working?
You still want to try and help them, and maybe helping them is asking another hypnotherapist or, you know, consultant hypnotist to take over.
Absolutely.
Because you know the fit would be better.
Yeah.
All right, so to wrap this up a little bit, I do have one thing.
It's 5 minutes since we've been talking.
You have, you're an author of many publications, I understand?
It's one of my guilty pleasures. I love writing books.
So tell us about what you've written.
I started off writing How to Communicate More Effectively, which, if you were listening to the start of this podcast, that goes all the way back to my early interest in how we use language. Lesson learned, I wouldn't write as much in my next book. It was 620 pages. It's great for keeping doors open. It probably should have been three books. So we had that one. Then Powerful Hypnosis Presentations. For me, a hypnotherapist needs to promote their business, and being able to deliver good presentations and demonstrations is important. And also, every single client session is a hypnosis presentation and demonstration. If you think of your pre-talk, if you think about your suggestibility testing and your hypnosis work.
That's true. So, on a smaller scale.
So, and people want to have an experience. You don't get that with a dentist. You just want them to do the job.
Yes.
But with hypnosis, they want the experience, the magic of some sort.
Yes.
So that was Powerful Hypnosis Presentations. Then there was Persuasive Therapy. So that's just simple phrases that you can just slip in there and here and there just to tweak and get that little bit extra out of a session.
And that was 500 pages?
No, that was only about 150, I think.
I'm being a wise guy.
I know. Then I moved on to Hypnogames.
Hypnogames,
which are fun developmental games for hypnotherapists and hypnotists and trainers to use. And these are in hypnosis or talking about hypnosis games that a group of you get together and do. So, for example, one of the games is that you sing a progressive induction to your recipient. Another is to bounce a ball while doing a group induction, a group hypnosis induction. Another is how you would deal with the ethical dilemma of having a client who says their Santa wants to move Christmas to July, wear an adult diaper, and wants to become a naturist.
Wow.
So these are games, they're all designed strategically to access knowledge and skills in different ways to really draw out what you know and learn from others. And then my final one was this year, I set myself a goal of how quickly can I do it? So I went from blank page to published on Amazon in 21 days.
Wow.
And it was Hypnosis, How to Hypnotize. And I had the most fun writing that.
Well, I would guess that that would be a little easier for you because you do that all the time. So
yeah, but it's written conversationally as though somebody was sitting there with me. And it was really great fun to write in that style.
It is fun.
And to get the cover designed. The only delay was Amazon sent me the proof copy. I was like, shall I wait for the proof? Yes, I'm going to have to wait for the proof.
I've learned my lesson on that.
Always wait for the proof, yeah. So, yes, I do. I've got about four that are part written, so I have no idea which the next one will be released. It's whichever one I feel most drawn to complete or write a new one.
There you go. That's great. And people can get that on Amazon.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's fabulous. Now, let me ask you, you attended the NGH convention. Have you learned anything?
Well, I've learned pieces. I've learned directly from what's been said. I've learned also, and I've been reflecting on this, I was saying to Timothy, who we were chatting to earlier, I've reflected on the differences because what I look for from a presenter, sitting here and watching and observing how other people interact, my people watching skills coming in, it's really interesting to notice what different people want from a presentation. So I've learned more that I can then put into my presentations to meet that wider audience, perhaps, than I might naturally think of.
Always looking to improve.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nothing wrong with that. Now, you presented as well?
I did.
What class or classes did you present?
It was Friday afternoon, which is an amazing time, so thank you for that. And it was on hypnosis presentations and demonstrations.
Great.
And it leads into my one-day post-convention on the same.
Excellent. So you've got that coming.
I have. Great. So people will be getting out and about doing presentations and demonstrations.
They say, excuse me, can I do a demonstration on you or something or practice, right?
That's it.
That's perfect. I appreciate you taking the time to sit with me.
You are welcome. It's been fun.
And we'll definitely have to bring you back for more.
Oh,
the next book. Okay? Thank you very much.
You are welcome.
Thank you for listening to the Hypnosis NGH podcast. You're welcome to share your ideas for future podcasts by emailing us, nghpodcast@ngh.net.